The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Our guest this evening is a writer named Tanisha Ford. She's also a researcher and cultural critic working at the intersection of politics and culture. Her latest book, Our Secret Society, is a biography of Molly Moon, the socialite, power broker, and founder of the National Urban League Guild, who was a key fundraiser for the civil rights movement. The book also serves as a social history and who's who of Black Americans from the 1930s through the 60s as Moon moved in New York and Harlem society circles that included the likes of Lorraine Hansberry and Langston Hughes. A history professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and a former Smithsonian Research Associate at the National Museum of American History, Ford's other books include Dressed in Dreams, Kwame Braithwaite, and Liberated Threads, which was awarded the 2016 Organization of American Historians Liberty Legacy Foundation Award. Tonight, she'll be in conversation with Mark Lamont Hill, Presidential Professor, Urban Education, also at the Graduate Center of CUNY. Hill is the recipient of honors from the National Association of Black Journalists, GLAAD, and the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, and he is the author of 6 books. Please join me in welcoming our guest to the Free Library.
Good evening, everybody.
Y'all must be the fam. Is this the fam right here? Y'all in the front row. Okay, over there. Okay. She's like, we don't all know each other. I understand. This is such an amazing, amazing opportunity to have a great conversation. I feel bad, Tanisha, that we work at the same job, and you got to come all the way to Philly for me to see you, and we're like one floor apart. But I couldn't imagine a better opportunity to talk about this wonderful, wonderful book. And I know some of y'all are seeing this book, heard the advertisements, have read the description, but haven't had a chance to read it yet. But I'm here to tell you, this is a really special, I'm going to say, brilliant book.
Thank you.
So thank you. First of all, thank you for writing it.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that, Mark.
I'm going to give you one more compliment before I ask you to talk to me about it. You know, a lot of people think that they are historians. That's the favorite thing people, well, political scientists and historians, people like to play both of them on TV and in their books. But being a real historian requires training and skill and understanding and care, and you have all of that because you are a PhD in history. But then there are people who are trained historians that don't know how to tell a story. Mm-hmm. What you managed to do is tell a beautiful story, a powerful story that changed the way I thought about some things. I'm actually embarrassed at what I didn't know. But you do it with the rigor and the thinking and the training of a historian, a master historian. So just thank you for mixing those two things and being, just giving, gifting the world with this book.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Yeah. I feel so seen. Speaking of, I think I'm going to put my glasses on so I can see shadows and outlines of faces of people I care about, and I want to be able to see you clearly because there are many people in this room I care about and love, family members who've traveled to see me, current and former students, colleague friends whom I've known since grad school. Like, it's amazing. Members of the guild, like, oh, thank you all for showing up. Thank you for your service. Like, this is just, it's incredible to be in community. And every time I come to Philly, I feel like Philly shows me love. So thank you. Thank you, Philly, for being here for me. And thank you, Mark.
Of course, of course. The question that I have for everybody when I ask them about their book, the first question is always, why this book and why now?
Yeah. So the why really extends to over a decade ago. You know, I started working on this book, or it was an idea back when I was a dissertator. So around 2010, I was sitting in the Schomburg and I was doing research in the archives and was looking for someone else and stumbled across the name Molly Moon. And I just love the name, Molly Moon, like, wow. And it just so happened that in the story I found, which was from 1961, she was hosting a beauty pageant, you know? And so there was, the woman I was looking for was actually a contestant in that pageant. And I thought, wow, here's a black woman in the early 1960s hosting a beauty pageant that's celebrating the beauty of black women. I want to know more about her.
Name Molly.
Name Molly, right? And I later learned that that was also her grandmother's name. Mm. So Molly was a family name. And so I just thought, I'm gonna write something about her. Like me, the dissertator, just thought, I'm gonna write a book about her after I finished this book that was gonna be, you know, the dissertation that was gonna be a book. But it started to make more sense to me as I was writing in 2020, now, you know, a decade after I had initially found her in the archive, to write this book that turned out to be about fundraising. Because, of course, many of these events, including that beauty pageant that I discovered, were fundraisers. That Molly Moon was a major fundraiser for the National Urban League through the vehicle called the National Urban League Guild that she founded in the early 1940s. And I'm writing about how the civil rights movement and the larger black freedom movement was funded as we're in an economic downturn in the COVID-19 era, and, you know, George Floyd had just been killed. And so to me, I was seeing all these parallels between the story that was unfolding in the archive in the 1950s and 60s and what was taking place in present day. And I thought, this is history that people need to know.
It's a history we need to know, partly because a lot of people just don't know who she is,
yeah.
Right? But there's also a way that our understanding, for those who do know of who she is very different.
Mm.
If I'm just reading the Amsterdam News,
yeah.
If I'm just opening up the paper and I'm hearing about social events and beauty pageants and things like that, I read her as a socialite, mm-hmm. exclusively, devoid of the politics, devoid of the history, devoid of the pre-1960s backstory, I think you talk about in the book. Talk to me about what it meant to interrupt the narrative, maybe that you had, but certainly that the dominant public had, about who Molly Moon was and who these types of people were to the world, to the black community.
You know, that is definitely a real thing, like this idea of the black socialite, or just socialites generally speaking, but black socialites in particular. I learned a lot in writing this book. So as I mentioned, I encounter Molly Moon in 1960, 1961, in newspaper clippings in the archive, but she was born in 1907. So by 1961, she's lived a rather full life. So the woman that I encounter in the archive in the 1960s is now a woman, you know, who is middle-aged. She has won this reputation as the grand dame of Harlem, you know, for the events that she was hosting, and a lot of those stories begin to separate her from her actual politics and from the amazing work that she was doing with the guilds and what the guilds had become by that moment. So I realized that I was coming into her archive sideways, right? So I had to write that sideways archive. And the ways I was able to do that largely was going through her personal papers, which, you know, one of the collections is housed at the Schomburg Center. And through reading her letters, I realized, wow, this woman was an incredible activist.
Yeah.
She was an intellectual. She was a social worker who, along with other people from Langston Hughes and Dorothy West, people who were, you know, literary figures in the so-called Harlem Renaissance, also people who were intellectuals who were part of that movement, including her future husband, Henry Lee Moon. I mean, they were the people who were trying to solve this social and economic issue around poverty in the black community. They were trying to, you know, determine what economic justice looked like for black communities. And Molly Moon was definitely a part of that. I mean, one thing that made that crystal clear for me was finding a piece that she wrote for the Crisis magazine about how women should organize to support factory workers in the Midwest, because she had ties to Gary, Indiana. And, you know, I was like, wow, this woman is a thinker. And she comes out of a black socialist tradition of thought. She was a part of a cohort of people who went to Moscow in the early 1930s to make a film, a propaganda film about labor exploitation and the horrors of Jim Crow in the U.S. South. The film was never made, but she was forever transformed by that experience in Moscow and later in Berlin, where she spent time as well in the early 1930s. So this was a woman who had a black internationalist perspective on the world. And when she comes back to the United States after that time sojourning in Europe, she has a deep commitment to the movement. So even when she forms the Guild, some of the earliest quotes I found of her describing the work of the Guild, she says that this comes out of a black organizing tradition, a woman-centered black organizing tradition, and she's very clear about that. So it was important for me to make those connections between this so-called socialite that I was discovering in the 1960s and this woman who had a really deep track record of black progressive thought and activism. And I found that socialite became a catch-all to describe many black women who were educated, who were seemingly connected to the black middle class, and who did work around volunteerism and fundraising. So Yolanda Robeson, who was married to Paul Robeson, she's labeled a socialite. Bessie Bearden, who was an activist in her own right, but some of us know her as the mother of the artist Romare Bearden, she was labeled a socialite. But again, someone who's deeply tied to the political scene in New York City at the turn of the 20th century. Jerry Major, who again, well, I mean, she was the queen of the society pages, but Jerry Major too was an activist. Mm-hmm. So my goal in writing this book was also to show that when we use this label of socialite, we can't use it in the same way that, you know, white elites use this term to describe the labor that black women are performing in terms of their activism and their intellectualism, because for us it's not a frivolous label in that same kind of way that we use it definitely in contemporary time. So my goal was not only to complicate the notion of socialite, but to explain that labeling Molly Moon as a socialite is really an injustice or a disservice to the work that she's done to aid black communities for decades.
I think I appreciated about the book also sort of how you reflect upon how you approached your research, how you approached the archive. Mm-hmm. Even the idea of saying you came at her sideways, which is, by the way, a wonderful way to kind of invoke the black vernacular tradition while still critiquing the violence of the archive. It was real smooth how you did that. Yeah, I came at her sideways. But it's a fascinating thing. It made me wonder a couple of things. One, to what extent, and you talked about you was trying to meld the socialite activist label, and that still seemed insufficient, to some extent. Is it that socialite, Is it that we have missed what it means to be a black socialite in general? Are these people outliers? Mm. Is socialite just is it inadequate or is it wrong? Are we mislabeling people? Like, were there people who were just throwing parties and organizing bourgeois middle class events?
I mean, you know, part of me wants to say yes, there were people who were just doing that, but and I don't want to say just like that didn't mean anything, but so many of these women were connected to the fight for racial equality that I even think that even in the time period that I'm studying, you couldn't be a black socialite and not care about racial equality. Like, that was definitely part of it. So what my good friend and big sister, Alelia Bundles, for example, is finishing up a biography of her namesake, Alelia Walker. And a lot of people wanted to label her as the joy goddess, you know, and, oh, it was just about the parties and the pleasure. And Alelia has done a lot of, you know, deep recovery work to say, no, these events were fundraisers. These events were supporting up-and-coming and established black artists. You know, so much of the work of the black socialite was connected to community building, institution building, fundraising. And I think that when people in the black community, particularly editors in the black press, were using this label socialite, part of what they were doing was giving black women space to lay claim to a certain kind of femininity mm-hmm. that, you know, historically had been denied them. So, like, by bestowing the label of socialite on these women, we're saying these women are on par with any white woman of equal social standing, class standing. And in many cases, these women kind of outshine their white counterparts.
Some of them had PhDs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right? These women had advanced degrees. You know, they worked outside of the home. They weren't the typical ladies who lunch socialite, right? So I definitely wanted to you know, reclaim that piece of the history, that the work of the so-called black socialite is far more complex than we often recognize, and that these so-called black socialites were power brokers. You know, a lot of them, they were the connective tissue between their local church, politicians, various social groups and organizations. I think in Molly Moon's case, it's interesting. I learned that she joined Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority as an undergraduate at Meharry Medical College. This was back when Meharry and Fisk had a joint chapter. She was initiated there, but she lets her membership lap for a number of years, and she doesn't join any black social clubs because of the, you know, her socialist impulses say that, you know, she doesn't want to be tethered to things that are considered like black and bourgeois. She later kind of makes an about face, and you know, definitely, you know, she reestablishes her ties with her sorority and other black women-centered organizations, but always with a civic thrust. So I think that those elements of her story and how and why she's framed as a socialite were really important for me to elucidate in the book. And while I, as you said, I toyed with, you know, socialite activist, like, you know, just to try to get it right, you know, because it is a complex identity, and the more than anything, I wanted to just show the complexities of it.
The complexity, I think, is the beauty of the book, again, both at the intellectual level, but also at the level of storytelling. I mean, you're talking about in Moscow, there are these black people, you said, making a propaganda film. This radical political formation is emerging, and they fly as hell, at least from what you tell me, right?
Like, it was important for me to tell you that too.
No. They look good. And the way you tell it is extraordinary. I mean, I didn't know these people existed in this way. Can you talk a little bit about? I'll get to the flop or the glamour part of it, but because I want to know about that too. But talk to me a little bit about this political formation, because I think that was the thing that was hardest for me to reconcile. Was that this woman who, a few decades later, would be throwing these extraordinary events, be responsible for these things that would be seen as the centerpiece of the black bourgeois establishment. We're engaged in these really radical anti-capitalist politics. How does Molly Moon become that? And not just her, but her cohort, because she's in there with some people who were, they're all radical. All kinds of interesting, progressive gender and sexual politics are happening. And, you know, again, as you described, book is interesting. How does this happen?
Yes, how does this happen? So I can't remember exactly when I first found evidence that Molly Moon was on that trip to Moscow, which I had learned about through reading Langston Hughes's memoir and reading Louise Thompson Patterson's biography. And I was like, oh, wow, Molly was on this trip too. Like, this is incredible. And there are other historians who kind of piece together elements of this trip and tell some of the history. Molly Moon is on the margins of those tellings, but I was able to use letters and things to kind of center her in my telling of that history. But from what I can tell, Molly Moon was born in Jim Crow, Mississippi. She was born in Hattiesburg. She then moved with her mother as a young child to Cleveland, Ohio, so she has Midwestern roots as well. And she later returns to Mississippi as an adolescent to attend Rust College's secondary school. So she receives her high school education there before going off to Meharry. And so I think that, you know, she was born into a working class or working poor black family. Mutual aid networks were extremely important to black migrant communities who, like Molly's family, had moved from the South to the Midwest and back again. So she had a sense of those kinds of things, as well as the value of education and the importance of education. So I wanted to, you know, really explain, like, why she would have been encouraged, deeply encouraged to go to college, even though her mother and her mother's generation did not attend college. They were all literate, you know. Even her mother had gone to the Rust Secondary School and then, you know, left school. A lot of African Americans didn't, you know, finish high school at that of that generation.
but she would have encouraged Molly to go on and to get receive higher education. And I think once Molly is at Meharry, I think there's a kind of social pressure to be a part of this like black emerging black middle class and pharmacy, having a degree in pharmacy as a black woman in the 1920s. I mean, that was a major deal. And so she marries a man who's also a pharmacist and they move to New Orleans. And they are part of the black bourgeoisie. I mean, they are, you know, he's an alpha, she's an AKA. They, you know, they're part of all these social
organizations. So stereotypical.
Look at you too, yes. You know, and but there's this whole scandal, and you can read it, you can read about it in the book. But I think that really sours her toward this very bourgeois politics and the limited way that they see gender and sexuality and the possibilities of womanhood for black women. And so she leaves the Deep South and goes to New York City, and she jumps right into this community of thinkers and intellectuals and artists. In fact, she moves into the building, which I think now is like the ABC building, but back then it was a building that was owned by a black mutual aid organization that had deep ties to in the 18th century in New York City. So she moves into this building. Zora Neale Hurston lives in that building. Dorothy West lives in that building. You know, she becomes friends with County Cullen and Claude McKay and Langston Hughes and all of these people, Louise Thompson Patterson. And so that's how she ends up on this trip, because Louise can't get trained actors to be in the film because no one wants to be tied to the emerging, you know, USSR. And they don't. They're afraid that they're going to be blackballed in Hollywood if they do this. So then Louise is going through her networks like, okay, who can I get to join this cast? And you have a lot of black people at this time who can't travel abroad. They can't travel internationally without a reason, right? And so this film gives them the reason. So a lot of them don't have ties to the Communist Party at all, but they have what we can think of as like new Negro intellectual politics, right? A new Negro vision for the world and self-determination and, you know, a radical vision for democracy in America. And Molly is part of this group who doesn't have any acting experience. Most of the people don't. A few people do have minor stage experience. And they join this cast. And I think when Molly is there, and she sees, you know, the centrality of the proletariat in the vision for a vision for, you know, a new world order, she can relate to that personally as someone who has very humble roots, who never fully fit into that, you know, black elite construction to begin with. And I think she is transformed politically by this experience. So politically, but also socially, I mean, they're deeply invested in the arts. They're spending their time attending the opera and eating fine cuisine and meeting people of opposite races and getting to date people from you know, opposite races. There were same-sex relationships. I mean, all of these things that they could not experience fully as African-Americans in the United States, they could experience a different kind of spatial, social, and cultural freedom in Moscow. And then later, she was in Berlin, as I mentioned. So this piece, for me, was important to set the stage in terms of, like, the kind of political and cultural and social awakening that would have shaped someone like Molly Moon, but also to say this is a cohort of thinkers. So also a part of that group were people like Frank Montero, again, another person who falls outside of the history, Lauren Miller, very instrumental in the NAACP's cases to end legal racial segregation in this country, but who, you know, takes a back seat in the archive, you know, to a figure like Thurgood Marshall. So he also was a part of this cohort of folks who were on that trip to make the black and white film. So the book follows these people and these relationships and how they shift over time and, you know, how the Cold War changes those relationships and how some people double down in terms of their connection to communism and other people.
Can you go there a little bit? Because your book actually pays great care to this question of Cold War politics and how it forces them and us maybe to reimagine these relationships. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, it was important for me, like you said, to write that history, but to write it with care and to write it with a relationship forward approach. So there's a chapter that's called Cold War Tensions, and what I love about that scene that I set there in that chapter, it was actually one of my favorite to write, in part because of the source material that it allowed me to use and the what the source material showed. There's a gathering. So Lauren Miller and his wife, Juanita, are in town in New York City after having moved, you know, back to L.A., where they, you know, have established themselves as power brokers in the Los Angeles community. They're back in Harlem, and Alta Douglas, who's married to the esteemed Harlem Renaissance painter Aaron Douglas, hosts a party for them. And all of, like, the black major civil rights leaders are there. Roy Wilkins is there. Henry Lee Moon, who at this point is now the publicity director of the NAACP, he's also there. Molly Moon is there, of course. The Millers are there, and other folks. And so I was able to use the coverage in the society pages of this event to say, yes, on the surface, this just looks like a gathering of bourgeois Negroes, right? But what people don't often understand is that the repression was so intense for anybody, even if you weren't a communist, if the government felt like you had leftist ties, they could label you a communist, and right, that could be dangerous. So a lot of these people had publicly disavowed communism. Others hadn't publicly done so, but had, you know, were alleged to have purged some of their papers to sever all ties. I'm thinking of Langston Hughes in this instance, who was also at this party. And so I used this dinner table to show the range of political leanings, affiliations, and ideologies that were all gathered around this dinner table at Alta Douglas's and Aaron Douglas's apartment at 409 Edgecombe, which, for anybody who knows New York City history, 409 Edgecombe is a legendary address. All the luminaries lived in that building. So it was great to kind of paint the scene there in that building. But to show that even though these people, there were fractious relationships in terms of the politics, they disagreed on issues, right? But there was still a kinship there. Right. And so I wanted to use that to show how, despite the ways that oftentimes we, even as historians, write and create this divide between, you know, the progressives were here and the radicals were here and the racial liberals were here and then, you know, and everybody's centrist and these are the accommodationists, that it didn't break down in the ways that we've imagined it. And then when you use a social setting to discuss these politics, you can see that people were using their seat at the table to have the hard conversations. And in my mind, one of those conversations was the Paul Robeson issue, right, which became a very divisive issue, particularly among the people who were on that trip to Moscow, because for a lot of them, Paul and Islanda were people they organized alongside. I mean, Molly Moon, when she, the body that she forms as a precursor to the Urban League Guild, Islanda Robeson is organizing right alongside her, right? So now once we get to the late 1940s and the NAACP has decided to, you know, go along with the State Department and the White House and disavow Paul Robeson, I mean, there's a divide between the friendship group because it's like, well, Paul, these are our people. Are we going to cast them aside? And so some people do say it's better to create distance there. And then other people say, no, we're going to double down. So I wanted to show the people like Louise Thompson Patterson, again, the organizer of the trip to Moscow in the 1930s, how she and her husband, they double down, right? And then the Moons, well, Henry has already made a public stance saying, you know, after the trip was a bust, he came out saying, you know, disavowing Stalin and the Comintern. But just to show, like, how these, the political relationships might have been strained on some certain levels, but the personal relationships remain. So just to have a more complicated conversation about politics, I mean, many of us, the holidays are approaching, we're going to sit at, you know, dinner tables with family members who might have differing political opinions than we do, but they're still your family, right? They showed up for you in a time of need, so do you just cast them aside because you have a different take on a particular political
issue? Let me push a little bit on that, because there's a way that that's absolutely true. But what I also got from the text was that there's a moment where people felt like she, I don't want to say jumped the shark, but like that her leftist roots and her radical politics had been somehow forfeited. Am I reading too much of that? I mean, it seemed like there's a moment where particularly with the younger generation, they were like, "You're not us anymore."
Yeah,
like,
so
you
that
mainstream.
Happens a little bit later. So that happens a little bit later than this moment. That
for sure. I'm sorry. I'm jumping a bit. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, this idea that you can have this complicated politics and this duality, it seems to hold there.
Yeah.
But as we get closer to the March on Washington, as we get closer to the end of her life, it seems like it falls apart. I'm trying to figure out what's different.
Yeah. So this moment that I write about at the dinner table, this happens, you know, in the early 1950s. And as Mark is pointing out, there's a political shift. There's a couple shifts that happen. So the one shift that I mark is the shift from a Lester Granger-led National Urban League to a Whitney Young-led National Urban League. And Whitney Young, I mean, they both have, there are things about both of their strategies that I think are admirable that I wanted to definitely give service to and pay attention to. I mean, Lester Granger, of course, was at the helm of the National Urban League for 20 years. So he shaped the organization in major ways for a long period of time. Whitney Young is a much younger leader, right, who comes from a different, you know, organizing tradition. He is definitely with more a more what I call militant professionalism approach. So he's definitely invested in bringing in social workers, people who are working on public policy, urbanists, nonprofit specialists. He wants to bring them into the league because he sees this as a moment where the league can do a lot of the, not only social services work, but a lot of the social science-based research around race and racism in the country. And so in Whitney Young's Urban League, people like Molly Moon represent the Granger era, an older era, and so a lot of them are pushed to the margins while he takes this more militant approach that's more in line with the direct nonviolent action that's, you know, becoming commonplace. Now, to be clear, Molly Moon herself is deeply invested in using the courts. So she's aligned with like an NAACP strategy of using the court systems to agitate for racial equality and public accommodations and so forth. But even as we move from Whitney Young, when he's, you know, installed as the director of the National Urban League around 1961, 1962, once we move toward 1964 on the other side of the March on Washington, and 1965, 1966, 1967, even Whitney Young, who is decades younger than Molly Moon, he is even being criticized by people who are decades younger than him. Like, we can think about Stokely Carmichael, for example. A lot of these people, even within the National Urban League, who, you know, their local affiliate might be more radical than like the national headquarters, local chapters of the NAACP, local chapters of CORE and SNCC, who are pushing back against what they see as these staid old guard organizations. So in that framework, and I think the media does a lot to like hype up the tensions between what they see as these two factions within the civil rights movement, the old guard, bureaucratic civil rights leaders of the 40s and 50s, and versus these young radicals who are taken to the street, who are disavowing nonviolence as an approach. I mean, the media is really amping these things up. And, you know, Molly Moon gets lumped in with that old guard in ways that are very uncritical, I felt. And so I wanted to hold in tension the fact that for many Black Americans, I mean, she had ascended to this grande dame status, which was where she was at when I first encountered her in the archive. She had ascended in many ways, so the Black press is covering her like we do Black royalty. Like, think about the people in our community who we revere and, you know, the stories that we write about them. Like, oh, wow, you know, Oprah drank water today. Wow, right? And there's like 10 stories about this, you know. That's how they were covering Molly Moon's movements through, you know, Black society. I mean, she had done all this work to elevate the Black community. By this point, there are guild chapters across the country, and many of those affiliates, those leaders are power brokers in their own right. And so there's a way that she's getting the queen treatment in the press, but that's only agitating this like anti-bourgeois response, like this anti-capitalist response. And by this point, many of the people who are seeing her as part of the problem, so to speak, know nothing about her long political record, right? And know nothing about like her as a, you know, a Marxist social theorist, for example. And so I wanted to like hold both of those things to say, like, on the one hand, this depiction of her isn't altogether false because she was, you know, a queen of society in many ways, but she still had deep ties to the community. I mean, she did send her daughter to a progressive school. So, you know, she and her husband still had these politics. I think that Carol Anderson does a great job in her book where she talks about like these bourgeois radicals and tries to even complicate this notion of what does it mean? You can be bougie and still be anti-capitalist, right? Like, right, you can have a critique of capitalism. So I wanted to do a similar thing and try to, again, serve that kind of complexity and the layers that I try to present throughout the book as I treat that issue of this transition in terms of the politics.
I'm being selfish with her time and mine, so I'm going to try and bring y'all into the conversation too. So if you have questions that you haven't pre-written, we'll take some, as long as they're related to the book, jump on in a second. I'm going to ask you just maybe one or two more questions.
Yeah.
I want to talk specifically, what's the legacy of the Guild?
No, I mean this way. I'm sorry, I'm talking to my mother.
No, no, look, that's way more important than anything I got to do.
Well, the significance of the Guild. That's why I wanted to shout out the Guild members who are here.
Right. When you said that, I was like, oh, wow, okay, yeah.
Yes. Let me just say, I have such a deep respect for you all and the work that you do because, you know, when Molly Moon established the Guild, and it was at the behest of Lester Granger, who... along with Molly Moon, they're both social workers. They both were looking for solutions to mass poverty, other forms of economic inequality in the workplace, inequalities in housing and education. So it was at his behest as he was, you know, stepping into the role of his executive director of the National Urban League, but he gave her free rein to create a vehicle in the ways that she wanted it to look. So her first major act as a fundraiser was actually fundraising for the Harlem Community Art Center, a left-wing art center at the center of Harlem, social and artistic life in the late 1930s and early 40s. She wasn't able to save that art center through her fundraising efforts, but many of the women, like I said, who were instrumental in helping her fundraise around that organization became the first members of the National Urban League Guild. And these women, you know, performed labor. At this time, it was mostly women, even though there were some men in the organization. And as it progressed into the 1950s, more men joined the ranks. And there are definitely men present in the guilds today. But they did this work without being paid. Mm. Most of them had families at home, full-time jobs. And they were still deeply committed to community-based volunteerism, service work, fundraising. They were, in many ways, the PR arm of the National Urban League. So they were the people who had, you know, the personal touch with the community. They were deeply embedded in their communities, and so they knew people. They were movers and shakers. A lot of them were, you know, also members of other social organizations, sororities, groups like Jack and Jill, The Lynx. They were active in their churches, right? So there's like this whole network that these people are a part of, especially into the 1940s, once many more black social organizations are formed. So their work was essential work to the guilds, I mean, to the National Urban League. And by the early 1950s, they decided that we're such an important vehicle for the National Urban League, we need to be recognized as people who do more than just host parties.
Right.
And so they established this National Council of Urban League Guilds. And that is an important moment in the history. And you start to see this mass proliferation of guilds from the end of World War II through the early 1960s. Some of them, Molly Moon was instrumental in forming. Other times, it was like a regional director of the National Urban League who was forming the guild in that particular city. And so I really just became fascinated with the work of the guild and how each guild in its respective city had its own approach to fundraising and community and institution building. They used different models of mutual aid and grassroots philanthropy. So there's a chapter, I think it's chapter 11. These chapters have all been different numbers at different points in time. So I think it's chapter 11. But I look at, you know, the various guilds. So I look at the Oklahoma City Guild, the Atlanta Guild, the Philadelphia Guild, just to try to show the range of work that the Fort Wayne, Indiana, that's where I'm from originally, the Fort Wayne, Indiana Guild, you know, the Grand Rapids, Michigan Guild, the Phoenix Guild, just to show like how essential guild work was to the movement of the National Urban League. So the Guild was a movement within a movement within a movement. And so I definitely wanted to shine light on that invisible labor of volunteer work that oftentimes is not honored in the ways that it should be.
So as you name these organizations, like there's a way that now we critique these very same organizations for their political, maybe apathy, maybe having the wrong politics, maybe invested in the wrong things. People say Black Greek letter organizations or Jack and Jill or all these other things just reproduce class gaps and all these other things, right? Mm-hmm. And then we look at this moment and a very different thing is happening. Does that mean that the organizations themselves have simply gone astray? Or was this just an unusual moment in history where these extraordinary people just happened to be in those organizations because that's all they could do, and that the organizations themselves actually aren't fundamentally built to lead us to freedom?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So I want to answer that. I want to try to approach this in a couple of different ways. One, by saying that kind of a tertiary story that this book tells is one about the establishment of a Black nonprofit sector. In Jim Crow era America, who's going to attend to our needs? Who understands the needs of the community but other African Americans in the community, right? So a lot of these women who were social workers, the skills of social workers translated really well to the world of PR and the world of nonprofit work. But a lot of Black women who had that skill set, because of Jim Crow segregation, couldn't use those skills and apply them in other nonprofit or PR jobs. Many of them chose to do that work. Some of them, even if they could have taken those jobs, didn't want to, chose to do that work within the Black community. So you have Black women who have a particular skill set that orients them toward social services related work, who are using, like you said, the organizations that are available to them to do that kind of work, to do, work in terms of fighting for economic justice. So I found even people like Thomasina Johnson Norford, who was one of the first lobbyists for Alpha Kappa Alpha, who's lobbying Capitol Hill, issues related to Black voting rights and so forth. So in many ways, people wouldn't think of the sorority as doing that kind of lobbying work with a social justice-focused initiative. And so this became a way for me to see, like, oh, they are using these institutions to do a particular kind of work. That doesn't mean that there wasn't room for critique or that they weren't critiqued. Okay. The critique was most certainly there. Even within the Urban League Guild, what I found in the mid-20th century, around the 1950s, mid-1950s, when younger people were wanting to join the Guild, some of them who had more of a militant stance thought that the Guild itself reproduced a certain kind of elitism. Mm-hmm. And so they thought, this isn't the organization for me. I need to maybe be a part of a more grassroots organization. So I don't know if it's necessarily... I do think that there's a way that being bound to a 501c3 status does limit the kind of political grassroots justice work that organizations can do versus, say, a 501c4, which allows you to at least be a protest organization. And that's questions that I've been thinking about. Like, just putting the social, like the sororities and social clubs aside, I mean, let me just say one little more thing about those. Like the Bridge Clubs, for example, I found we're doing fundraising work for, CORE and SNCC, yeah. Right? So
amazing.
People might think the bougie Black people playing cards, like what a, but no, they were actually, and they, so a lot of these infrastructures that may not have been meant to be these, more militant or radical justice organizations, once they had leadership at the helm who had a more radical vision, they would then steer the organizations to do some more of this radical work. So that's the last thing I want to say about the social clubs. But broadly speaking, what I'm interested in thinking through and continuing the conversation even beyond today is, what does it mean to be like a well-funded justice organization? And is that the goal? So once the Urban League starts accepting all this money from corporations and foundations, there were people who critiqued where that money was coming from and that money would steer the movement away from these more radical impulses that it could have and that people had seen it have, particularly in the Depression era with the National Urban League and its work with domestic laborers. toward other issues that satisfied those funders who were giving money to the organization. So I am interested in thinking about not just the limitations of Black people, like, oh, what have Black people done and what could we have done different or what should we have done better? I mean, you and I are both members of Greek letter organizations, right? I mean, there are things to be said that we could say, but also I wanted to think about the structures that our work is slotted into and how the larger structure also creates a problem in terms of the ways that it can advocate and agitate for racial justice.
Wow. I mean, I'm going to move to y'all.
Well, I want to hear you say something about that, and then...
No, I mean, that was a great answer, by the way. When you ask academics questions, they give answers in a way... Like, I now have, like, five more questions. But I think my brain is going the way yours is. And I think there isn't a simple answer to this.
Right.
You know, because my initial thought reading this was... My fear reading this, rather, was that we would romanticize these organizations and believe that we were in a golden age of bourgeois Black movement organizing. And if we could just recover the original roots of these organizations, right, we could get free playing bridge or, you know, whatever. And you don't let us off the hook that easy, but you also don't let us believe that it's not possible to do radically different work within the context of these, and that all these structures are going to be constraining in some form or fashion. And I think from the book, I was able to sort of imagine a path forward. I don't know exactly what it is, and what I'm hearing you say is that we don't know, right? Who knows, right? But that there's a path forward through these organizations, at least that has some value to it, with critique and with contradiction. And that was helpful for me, because honestly, I probably was more dismissive of them. And even of that history.
Yeah, I mean, me too. Admittedly, me too. Like, even though, I mean, my mom's Greek, you know, my grandmother's Greek, my grandfather's Greek. I mean, like, there are ways that I too have questions. But what I tried to do in this, I wanted this book at its core to be a book that was about Black dignity. And so that unless, as a Black person, you was just doing some really wild-ish, right? Like, I wasn't trying to throw people away. I was at least trying to understand, like, what could be the impulse behind this move, behind this decision, and to really just show a full range of Black thought, of Black strategies around fundraising, of Black joy practices, and allow the reader to enter in the conversation where they are and see how they interpret the history. And so that's why I asked you to give the, because I know you and I know your politics, and so I wanted to hear, like, what, how did it read for you? Because there are characters in the book who I think are stand-ins for me in each chapter. Like, there's somebody who I'm like, that asked me, if you know me, then you know that that's me, right? That's me, you know, I'm speaking through this character. But I wanted characters that represented even people who didn't believe what I believe, who don't have the same politics that I have. So that maybe as a, you know, as a constellation of Black thought and ideas and creativity and joy and love, that we could imagine something different, you know. So
no, that comes through in the book, and again, the elegance of the writing and the clarity of the storytelling allow us to imagine these moments of radical struggle and dissent also as spaces simultaneously of joy and the assertion of dignity and agency and radical imagination. All this stuff is happening at one time, and sometimes it might be at a bridge table, sometimes it might be on a runway, sometimes it might be making a film, it might be a party, whatever. And that's the beauty of the book, I think. And anyway, I guess I don't want to, could gush about this book.
Let me
for
say
a long
just
time.
One last thing too. And what another piece of that too that I wanted to show was that even these young radicals, you know, who are part of the, you know, the Black Panther Party and others, what they quickly found too was that we need money as well. And a lot of them were going to, you know, the Hollywood elite.
The ones they was talking stuff about.
Yes, you know.
Yes, that
you know?
Yeah.
So I'm like, so my whole point was that it's a trick bag, right? Like, you know, so what are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do? And that's that it's that kind of thinking that I really wanted to compel readers to have. Like, what do you, if even the Black Panthers are like, you know, showing up on the Upper East Side in full Panther regalia, like you know,
beret in hand,
right? Because they need
funds, some money.
Right, to fund the breakfast programs and this and that and the third. Like, what do we do with that? What do we do with that? And so, I just wanted to have at least some kind of radical honesty around the stakes, and that's why I wanted to also make sure that we had that I introduce the names of these foundations and these philanthropies who were all up in the mix, because oftentimes the conversation turns in on itself and it's bougie black people against working class black people and it's us against us, and it becomes this destructive narrative within our community. But that hand of white philanthropy is often missing from the conversation. And so I wanted to do the legwork in those archives as well. I spent days at the Rockefeller Archive Center, like going through the papers of these foundations to understand, like, what was their role in all of this? What was their role in funding the March on Washington, for example? So that we could really try to grapple with this complex history around this, you know, nonprofit industrial complex.
Oof. So much. It's just so much there. Even with the Rockefeller, we could spend another 20 minutes just talking about that. Let's get to a couple of these questions. Again, if you have a question, raise your hand. How much money did the civil rights movement garner?
Yeah, that's a difficult one to calculate, because there were so many organizations, and part of it depends on how do we define the civil rights movement. But the National Urban League in and of itself, in the period that I studied it, and today's figures, I mean, they were bringing in millions of dollars, right? Through that organization, through the sponsors, through everyday grassroots donors. But what was interesting for me is how much money the black community has raised just to support something like securing the civic right to vote. Billions of dollars we've raised, you know, just to support our right to vote, to end voter suppression. That to me was astounding, you know, that even with the Civil Rights Act, once I started even looking in present day at the money that like Black Voters Matter and other organizations are raising to protect the right to vote for Black people to vote. It's just astounding that these Civil Rights Acts don't really change the reality that so much of our fundraising is still going toward an issue like voting rights.
It's insane. We got this one just came in from Sandy Moon Hightower, who says, "All my life I was told that we are related. I am a Gilder. Hope it's true. Looking for info." So we go. Maybe y'all two could connect. And Sandy, I've been hearing that name, Sandy Moon Hightower, my whole life. You and my mama worked together at Pastorius Elementary School in Germantown here.
Look
so.
At that.
Every day since I've been about 5 years. Hey, Sandy Hightower was talking about this. I was like, do they ever teach? None of the stories are about teaching. It was always about all the stuff. All right. Why hasn't the story of the secret society come to light before your research?
Yeah, I think there are many factors. I mean, one is one that I mentioned before, so I won't delve into it too deeply, but it is... The first wave of moving a lot of these people who were leading figures in the 1930s and 40s, and even into the 1950s, like displacing them post Brown v. Board, like moving toward different strategies and those people becoming marginal to the history. I think that's part of it. And even, you know, within the Urban League, there's a way that they definitely celebrate Whitney Young and his leadership. I think the fact that Whitney Young died young, Whitney Young died young and unexpectedly.
Yeah.
Some people thought that there was a suspicious death, that maybe the CIA was involved. I mean, there's all sorts
Black people think about that. Everybody right? that dies, though, right?
You know, yeah. Right, he drowned, just to be clear. Like, this was, yes. But, like, you know, there were people who, you know, thought, like, this could be a conspiracy. But anyway, the larger point is that people within that he became a figure that was largely celebrated, understandably so, in the National Urban League. But it means that people like Molly Moon, it wasn't until like the late 1980s that they established a volunteerism award in her name. And so that became a wave of recovery. But you know, as scholars of this history, these things happen in waves. We remember, then we forget that we remembered at one point, you know? So, you know, I'm joining a wave of black women who had worked to reclaim Molly Moon. This started to happen around the 1970s and early 80s. Mm-hmm. So my work in certain ways is picking up from that. I think another issue is once we as historians of especially people from a Black studies bent in history, once we recognize the fallacy of the great man, top-down, big event, civil rights movement study, we then started to do these bottom-up grassroots histories and narratives of the civil rights movement, which were really helpful for me as I started to write this book. But it meant that those people like Molly Moon, who, you know, once we start thinking about that, you know, classic civil rights movement era in the 1950s and 60s, well, by that point, she's deemed a bourgeois, you know, person who, you know, is all about the parties and Waldorf Astoria and integration. And so she would fall outside of that work on the grassroots. And then in histories of that earlier time period, because once we started to have the intellectual history turn, you know, and reclaiming a lot of the Black intellectual figures of the 1920s and 30s, she's left out of that era because she's not yet a public figure. So to really find her, you have to know to look for her. You have to go to her papers in order to really situate her within that that cadre of new Negro intellectuals of the 20s and 30s. So there's a way that the spaces that she would have been have fallen out of the narrative, like the history of the Harlem Community Art Center and the New Deal art community art centers more broadly fall outside of a lot of this history. So the places where she was, those are the places that haven't received the attention that they need. And so part of why I'm able to do this work is because I'm both utilizing a, you know, long Black freedom movement approach connecting the 1930s to the 1960s, but I'm also looking at the intersections of art and labor in certain ways. Looking at this question of money and fundraising brings a whole other cast of characters onto the stage. So like, when you meet Frank Montero at the beginning of the book in the 1930s in Moscow, I mean, he's like a senior at Howard University. He's a mentee of Ralph Bunche. When we encounter him again in the middle of the book, he's now a person who's working with the National Urban League, is one of their major financial managers of this, you know, low-key secret National Urban League fund, where they're receiving all these money from major corporations and foundations before publicly they want to announce that they're receiving money in this way. But this is young Frank Montero, right? But he too has fallen out of a lot of this history as well. So part of what I'm able to do by doing the long history approach, looking at arts, labor, and economics, and following the fundraising trails, I'm able to kind of bring together some of these overlooked histories and give light to the work of this so-called secret society.
Well, you certainly do that. This book is really just masterful. Again, like I said at the beginning, you know, very few people have the historical chops to recover this history, and even fewer have the ability to tell the story in a way that we can all understand and access and honestly be transformed by. I mean, this book is extraordinary. I encourage everybody to buy a copy. That's me as a scholar. Me as a bookstore owner say everybody should buy two copies. And Tanisha, I'm honored to call you a colleague and a friend, and I'm grateful for you teaching us so much in this text and in all of your amazing books. So just thank you for spending some time with us tonight. We're going to give you all some time. Andy's going to come up and give the logistics, but just let's give her a round of applause and let's go hang out and buy some books.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.